15, I think it is. Not 16. You're probably thinking 16. I want to talk about how the resurrection in the end impacted three individuals in one group of people. But to do so, I want us to think about Good Friday for a moment. And I want us to think about how people woke up that morning and what they thought their day was going to be, what they imagined the day was going to be like, and how at the end of the day it had changed, and by the end of the weekend, maybe their entire lives had changed. Now, I'm thinking of three individuals in particular, but let me talk about at least, not two groups, but a group and one individual that also, in a sense, didn't wake up that day thinking that the day would end differently than it did. The first is Jesus. First of all, he didn't wake up that day, did he? Because he had never gone to sleep. And I can assure you that in the morning on that Friday, Jesus knew exactly how that day was going to end. He knew exactly how it was going to end. In fact, Jesus, we know, because of his absolute trust in the Father, he knew how the weekend was going to end, didn't he? He knew how that was going to end. So no surprises for him. Do you know, there's another group of people I'm not so sure they were surprised either. And that is the group of the religious leaders. The religious leaders, I don't think they went to bed that night either. Because if you read the text, they seem to have been up all night long plotting. They were plotting exactly what was going to happen on Friday. They had plotted with Judas the betrayal. They had plotted how they would bring Jesus before Herod and before Pilate to try to get him condemned as a criminal and as an insurrectionist and crucified on a Roman cross. That was their plan all along. And the day ended exactly the way they imagined it. Well, let me suggest something to you. I'm not so sure the weekend ended differently than they imagined it. Now, that might shock you. What are you saying, Tom? You think the religious leaders saw the resurrection coming? Well, I think they saw something coming. Or they wouldn't have posted a guard. And the nonsense story about the disciples stealing the body was just that, a nonsense story. There are several statements made by Caiaphas and the different. These guys were not surprised when those Roman guards came back and told the story of Jesus' resurrection. They do not come across, first of all, they certainly didn't respond to it in faith, but they don't even seem surprised. It's almost as if, I'm not going to say they saw it coming, but they feared it coming. They feared it coming. We'll come back to them. There are three others, though, I want to focus in on. Their days, didn't start the way, they started the way they thought they would, but they ended entirely different. And they're all mentioned in the crucifixion of Christ. And I want to think about each one of them in light of the resurrection. I will just tell you the three we will focus in on. The first is a man named Simon of Cyrene. His day was planned. It did not go as planned. The second is a thief who died next to Christ. Now you might say, well, he sure knew what was going to happen that day. Yeah, but I don't think he knew how it was going to end. He knew what was going to take place during the day, but he had no idea how that day would end for him. And the third is a centurion. He had no idea what was coming that day. He was woke up early, and news had come that his services were needed. Oh, I suspect that he was already called to be in charge of a crucifixion, because the crucifixion was going to be happening that day one way or the other. But he had no idea what was going to happen on that day and how it would impact him. So let's read Mark chapter 15, verse 16. And we will pick the story up right after Jesus has been condemned to die. The soldiers led Jesus away into the palace, that is the praetorium, and called together the whole company of soldiers. They put a purple robe on him, then twisted together a crown of thorns and set it on him. And they began to call out to him, "Hail, King of the Jews!" Again and again they struck him on the head with a staff and spit on him. And falling on their knees, they paid homage to him. And when they had mocked him, they took off the purple robe and put his own clothes on him. And then they led him out to crucify him. You notice, as we pause here, we're going to start with the centurion. You notice that, and I didn't even pick this up, that Jesus was mocked after he was condemned. It's not as if. These soldiers actually took Jesus back to their own barracks, to where they lived. And the whole guard was called together. Now, in a crucifixion, there probably would only be about four or five soldiers, that would be used in the context of the crucifixion, that would have some kind of duty within that. But this sounds to me like that all of the Roman regiment there that was housed in that praetorium, in that palace, they all came together to mock Jesus. And that tells me that most likely the centurion would have been present. Now, we don't know what kind of involvement he may have had in it, but it looks to me like they were all involved, doesn't it? Doesn't it look like the whole group was involved? And I've got to anticipate or suspect that the centurion was certainly involved. He may not have been leading it, but he may have been since he was their leader. But look what's going on. And they are mocking him, and they are hitting him and spitting on him. And those of us that have seen maybe one of the crucifixion movies, like The Passion of Christ, man, the brutality. I remember when I watched The Passion of Christ, I just wanted it to end. It's one of the few movies I'm like, other than a real bad movie, would it just please end? Because you just couldn't watch it. That's how our centurion began his day. If you would have pulled him aside at that point and said, "You know how you're going to end this day? Surely this man is the Son of God." He'd have thought you're crazy. What could possibly happen on this day to take a centurion who with his men are bringing such ridicule, such mockery, such horrific pain upon Christ? What could happen? And so as we read the story, I think we need to pay attention. And even before we leave the room of the praetorium, there's already something happening that I think is probably beginning to disturb the Roman centurion. And we get it from the words of Peter in his letter, that Jesus was silent, like a lamb led to the slaughter. I suspect that Romans abused their prisoners all the time before they crucified them. But I suspect rarely, if ever, someone responded to that abuse like Jesus had that day. That there were no cursings back. There was no complaint. There was no opposing. There was no physical reaction, just humbly, silently submitting to the abuse. I wonder if the centurion, as he watched, was already starting to think, this man's different. What's going on here? Well, they drag him out and they haul him off to the cross. We'll read the passage a couple of times, but we are now reading it thinking of the soldiers. A certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus, was passing by on his way and from the country, and they forced him to carry the cross, they being the soldiers. Jesus, so weak from the abuse that he had already received, couldn't even carry the cross up to the place of his execution. and had collapsed. And so the soldiers looked around, and here comes some poor passerby Jew, and they grab him and they throw him under the cross, say, "You carry it for him, because we don't have all day. We got a crucifixion to get to." And so they bring him up to the place of the skull, called Golgotha. In verse 23, it says, "Then they offered him wine mixed with myrrh, but he did not take it." It's actually the soldiers that offer him that. That is the only act of mercy that these Roman soldiers would ever show anyone, is that, and it was not uncommon, that they, and maybe it wasn't so merciful, but the wine and vinegar was offered up because it would deaden the senses. It was like giving somebody morphine that is coming to the end of their life, to make it a little bit more palatable for them to be able to handle it. And so it's an act of mercy and grace. Now, Mark's gospel skips right over the fact that it's these Roman soldiers that drove the nails into his hands and into his feet, and which this centurion would have been watching over. That would probably be nothing new for him, though. This is something that he may have had as a regular part of his job. And I do suspect that it was a regular part of their job. It was probably customary for them to offer the wine vinegar as one last, it's like what we do. We give a last meal. Well, this is their last act of a gracious thing that one human being can offer to another. I wonder how many people like Jesus refused it. And I wonder if that caught the centurion's attention. Jesus said, "No, thank you." Now, he didn't say that, but he would not drink it because he didn't want his senses deadened. He wanted to be completely thinking about what was happening. He wanted to be alert, and he refused to take it. I wonder if that had an impact on the centurion, or if later, after they offered it and they crucified him, dividing up his clothes, they cast lots to see what each would get. I'm assuming that centurion and the four other guards are probably participating in this. It was a common practice to take the victim's things where they were worth any money, and they would normally just divide them up, but they cast lots because they didn't want to tear Jesus' garment that was of a single piece of wool and consequently was worth more money. So they basically drew lots for it, or bet on it. And while they were doing it, though it is not in Mark's gospel, it is in Luke's, the words came from Jesus that said, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." They don't know what they're doing. I have to think the centurion heard that. And by the way, I think it's pretty clear when you read all four Gospels that those words are directed towards the Roman soldiers. Jesus wasn't saying, "Father, forgive all of humanity. They don't know what they're doing." In particular, I do not think Jesus was saying, "Father, forgive those religious leaders out there. They don't know what they're doing." Because the truth is, they knew exactly what they were doing. Caiaphas knows that Jesus is the Messiah. He just doesn't want this kind of a Messiah. He knows exactly what he is doing. I think those words, if you read them in the context of the Gospels together, you see they're directed specifically to the Roman soldiers who had crucified him. "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they're doing." When was the last time a Roman heard a Jew ask their God to forgive them? Well, I'll tell you when it was. Never. Never. Never had that centurion heard such words come from a Jewish man's mouth. Never had any of those Roman soldiers heard such a thing. "Father, forgive them." Let alone in a context where you had just drilled nails through his hands and his feet. Maybe that was what made an impact. I have to think, if he hadn't been impacted by this point, something's going on in his heart. It is stirred. It is challenged. Now, as we read on in Mark, we don't get some of the other details that Matthew told us in the passage. Well, we didn't read it this morning, but in Matthew's version of this crucifixion, But we do see here that it was 9 in the morning when they crucified him, verse 25. And the written notice of the charge against him read, "The King of the Jews," and they crucified the rebels with him, one on his right, one on his left. And those who passed by hurled insults at him, shaking their heads and saying, "So you who are going to destroy the temple and build it in 3 days, come down from the cross and save yourself." And in the same way, the chief priests and the teachers of the law mocked him among themselves. By the way, I think it's in Luke's gospel, the Roman soldiers joined in with this little mockery. They too said to Jesus, "If you're really a king, then come down off the cross and prove it to us." They joined in with that mockery. Now, did the centurion, I don't know at this point, he may have already been becoming disturbed, but some of the other soldiers certainly participated in this mockery. But something else happens here that we can, if we can pick it up in verse 33, that may have had an impact on the centurion. "And at noon, darkness came over the whole land until 3 in the afternoon." Well, you know, the ancient world, they were used to eclipses. And an eclipse was an omen. And let me tell you, if an eclipse happened at this time, that's all it would take for many people in the ancient world to say, "What's going on here? Is God trying to tell us something?" They would get a little nervous if an eclipse took place while they were crucifying this man. I don't know how much you guys know about eclipses, but how long does an eclipse last? Not 3 hours. A couple of minutes. Guys, that's all it would have taken. God could have sent an eclipse for a couple of minutes and the message would have gotten across. But it went dark for 3 hours. Now that's not an eclipse. That's a sign. And when you read Matthew's gospel, this disturbed not just the centurion, but all of the Roman soldiers. In fact, it says there that they became terrified. They became terrified. They were filled with fear. And this centurion is observing this. Matthew adds that the temple's curtain was rent from top to bottom. Now, that would have happened in the city, and maybe they wouldn't have heard about it out at the cross. The word may not have traveled that quickly. But there were events going on that this centurion was watching, and he was saying, "There's something up here with this person." So much so that as Jesus cries out in his last words, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing near heard this, they said, "Listen, he's crying to Elijah." Guys, it's not because they misheard Jesus that they said that. We often forget this. Jesus is quoting Psalm 22 from the Hebrew. "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani" is Hebrew, and it means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" But believe it or not, Israelites in Palestine in the first century didn't speak Hebrew. They spoke Aramaic. Aramaic was a language that had similarities with Hebrew, but it wasn't Hebrew. So when they heard Jesus say these Hebrew words, it sounded to them like in their own language, Elijah. And so they pause, and they say, when some of those standing near heard this, they said, "Listen, he's calling Elijah." And someone ran and filled the sponge with wine vinegar and put it on a staff and offered it to Jesus to drink. Now, this is the second time. Now he's right at the point of death. "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to take him down," he said. Now, if I was one of the guys that crucified Jesus, I don't think I'd want to hang around to see if Elijah came and took him down. Because if Elijah does come and take him down, I'm not in a very good spot. So they obviously don't really believe that's going to happen. And with a loud cry, Jesus breathed his last, and the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. And when the centurion who stood there in front of Jesus, the man had a front row seat on the greatest event in history, next to the resurrection, a front row seat, And when he saw Jesus and how he died, he said, surely this man was the Son of God. Whatever happened that day, it was enough to change a centurion from a cynical Roman soldier who hated Jews and had no problem at all abusing them, spitting on them, crucifying them, to a man who at least was contemplating the question, who is this man? Who is this Jesus? Surely he is who he claims to be. That's quite a change. So let's just quickly jump ahead 3 days. What did the resurrection mean for this centurion? Well, unlike many people in Jerusalem, this centurion would have heard about the resurrection. Do you know why? Because there was a Roman guard in front of the tomb, and word would have got back. Now, I know they gave a different story, but I can't imagine that those Roman soldiers, first of all, I can't imagine that this centurion, when he heard something happened at the tomb, would not have been questioning them, would not have questioned, what happened? And I cannot imagine those Roman soldiers telling him a lie. So though the rest of Jerusalem may have been hearing that the disciples stole the body, that centurion would have known. He would have heard the story of an earthquake and of an angel and of an empty tomb. Now, there are lots of fiction books that have gone on to try to tell us what happened to the centurion. We don't know. Lew Wallace wrote the book The Robe. He shows up there. He also wrote the book Ben-Hur. He shows up there. He's the character in the new movie, Risen. He shows up there. And we are fascinated with what may have happened to him. But the fact is, we really don't know what happened. Any more than we know often when we proclaim the gospel to people and tell them the story of Jesus' death and what he has done for them, many times we wonder, will that story have an impact on their life? Will it change them? Will it change them for a moment in the midst of an Easter service or a Good Friday service? Or will it change them for a lifetime? Will they become a follower of Jesus for a lifetime? Only God knows. Only God knows how this had a last, if it had a lasting impact on the centurion. But we do know this, he would have heard of the resurrection. And God had already primed him that this man was more than he thought him to be. Well, what about the second character in the story? Let's go back. The second character in the story is in verse 21. I'd like to start his story long before here. I want you to imagine that there is a place in this world that you have always wanted to visit. But for the most part, it's out of reach for you to visit it. So sometime in your 20s, you start saving money for a vacation that you know that you cannot take until your 60s. Every day, you put the change left in your pockets in a jar. And on that jar, it has some destination. Maybe it's New Zealand. For my kids, it might be Hobbiton, New Zealand. Maybe it is Maui. Maybe it's Europe. But you're going to save your whole life for it. You plan every aspect of that trip, your whole life. And when you finally have your 60th birthday party, your family comes together with all that you've saved, and they have a big going away party because you are now going to take probably 2 months, 2 months vacation, and you're going to visit this place. And in the midst of that vacation, there will be an event that takes place that you have always longed to be a part of. Maybe you're going to Spain and you want to run with the bulls at the age of 60. That would be very foolish, but maybe that's been your life's dream. And you have anticipated it your whole life. And you get there, and it's all that you thought it would be. The crowds are massive. The excitement is rising. And you are heading to that place where I guess they start running. And as you're going there, your wife is driving and you are just anticipating what you've been anticipating your whole life. And just before you get there, a policeman pulls you over. He pulls you over and asks for your papers, and pretty soon, you know, he's starting to give you a hard time, and, oh, I'm sorry, we're going to have to take you downtown. And so you end up downtown in wherever it's at. It's not in Barcelona or Madrid. I can't think of where they run the Bulls right now. And you end up downtown in their local constable's office in a jail while your dream slips away. Buddy, that's an inconvenience. I understand that because this is one of the kinds of things that I am way too easily frustrated by things. Way too easily. Mary can attest. It drives her crazy. Amazing. It actually drives me crazy that I'm so easily frustrated. When I read the story of Simon, I think, man, can I identify with how this guy must have felt. Because you see, Simon is from North Africa, from Cyrene. That is on the other side of the world from Jerusalem. A Jewish person is responsible for once in their life, they must make a trip to Jerusalem if they are a faithful Jew. They must come and celebrate the Passover one time in their whole life. You know what? When you live on the other side of the world, it would take your whole life to plan that trip. Your whole life. You would have to save for it. How many ancient people had the kind of jobs you could take 2 months off for, because that's what you'd have to do. 2 months without working in a land not your own. You would have to save for years and years and years to have the kind of finances to sustain you and your family for a pilgrimage to Jerusalem for 2 months if you lived in Cyrene. And that's what this man had done. And it's Passover morning. You had been waiting your whole life to be in that temple when they killed that lamb with your family, celebrating it with the priests. And you get up that morning and your day is planned. Let me tell you, every minute of that day is going to be planned. And you're not that wealthy, so you're not living inside of Jerusalem. You had to find some kind of camp outside of Jerusalem. But that's okay, because it's really all about being at the temple for the Passover. And you get your kids up early, and you get everybody going and cleaned up and in their best clothes, and you begin your march down the Mount of Olives to head into Jerusalem for the one day you've waited your whole life for. And just before you enter the city, some Roman guard says, "Hey, you coming in, you right there, over here. You're going to carry this man's cross." Wow. What an inconvenience. What a disappointment. I can't carry it. I'm on my way with my family to the Passover. I'm from Cyrene. Pick some local. They get to celebrate this every year. Don't pick me. This is my once in a lifetime trip. You know, get over here and carry that cross. Can you imagine how he must have felt? Can you imagine that kind of inconvenience? Can you imagine him? "God, how can you let this happen to me? How can you do this? We've come so far to celebrate the Passover, to worship you. How in the world can you allow this to happen to me now and make a total wreck of all that we've been planning our whole life? How could you do this, Lord?" Could you imagine him saying that? I can imagine it. Guys, I can't even imagine how frustrated I would be. The Roman soldiers would probably have to kill me. I would be so angry. I wouldn't be able to contain it. It would frustrate me so much. All of those plans, all of that, and just gone when a soldier looks over at me and our eyes connect. "Get over here. Carry this man's cross." Wow. What an inconvenience. Isn't it amazing what God can do with an inconvenience in your life? That's the lesson of Simon. The next time you are really frustrated because God somehow has allowed some person or some event or something to inconvenience you, to get in the way of your plans, to frustrate you, and in my case, to make you so angry you can hardly stand it. Maybe we should pause and think about Simon and say, I wonder what God is doing. I wonder if this particular inconvenience in my life might be the best thing that ever happened to me. Wouldn't that be a great way to handle inconveniences? The policeman pulls you over, you're going to be late for your son's wedding. Oh, what are people going to say? Maybe this is the best thing that ever happened to me. Who knows what God could do with it? What did he do with it with Simon? Wow. Guys, if there was ever a person where God is in control of every little thing so that Simon crosses the path of Jesus at just the right time, it was this day. The fact that Jesus could carry the cross no farther. Somebody should write a song about this. From Simon's perspective, Jesus carried the cross just far enough for me. Just far enough. See, if Jesus drops the cross somewhere in the city, some other poor person is going to be thrown on it. Who knows if it will make a difference in his life? But Jesus knew God has an appointment. He has an appointment with Simon. I got to at least get this cross to Simon. He drops it at just the right time. He becomes weak at just the right moment because God had ordained it, that that cross would fall then and that Simon would be there then and he'd pick it up. How do I know it made such an impact on Simon? Well, there are actually a lot of reasons, but the biggest isn't just a subtle thing as we read it, and I've mentioned it before here. In verse 21, a certain man from Cyrene, Simon, the father of Alexander and Rufus. That is a meaningless comment. Why do I care that Simon is the father of Alexander and Rufus? Better question, why do the people in Rome that Mark is writing to care what the names of Simon of Cyrene's children are? If this is his only appearance in Scripture and he goes away, it makes no sense. You would never mention his children's name. Another question might be simply this. How does Mark know the names of Simon's children? Why would he? If you were just, you watched an event, you saw a man. First of all, how does he know Simon's name? Where did he get Simon's name? All we would have seen if you were a witness, and if Simon was a man who just carried Jesus' cross, and that was the end of the matter. In other words, if Simon would have done what so many of us would have done, bore that cross to Calvary, got it off our backs, and got our family back down in Jerusalem and on schedule with our plan for the day. That's what most of us would do. I got to get back on my plan. We would not know what Simon's name is. We would just know some man carried his cross and then quickly as he could got out of there as fast as possible and down to the temple with his family to celebrate the Passover. But apparently Simon didn't do that. And apparently Simon stuck around long enough. Well, he had to stick around longer than just being at the cross. How do I know that? Well, because the disciples weren't at the cross. Consequently, they would not know his name is Simon. Well, when did they find out who this guy was and what his name was? Well, I would suggest they may have had to wait all the way till Pentecost before they found out who he was. But one of the things that we see, Mark telling the Roman church that Simon's sons are Alexander and Rufus, there is only one way you can read that. They knew them. The Roman church he was writing to knew Simon's sons. They were part of the church. Surprise, surprise. When the letter of Romans is written by Paul in the 16th chapter, he lists numerous people that he knows in Rome. One of them is a man named Rufus and his mother, who had become a co-worker of Paul's somewhere along the way. Maybe Antioch, where we know that people who in Pentecost from Cyrene embraced the gospel message that Peter preached, who stayed in the city until Stephen's persecution and fled the city and ended up in Antioch, planted a church. Men from Cyrene planted that church in which Paul would eventually go and be sent from. Maybe Paul met her there. And maybe it's because the men from Cyrene is Simon, and eventually maybe his kids. They may have been older at this point. They became leaders in the church. What a difference it made. But what I want us to pause and think about is two things. When I think about Simon, he is the one character that really convicts me, because it is the thing that I have the hardest time letting go of. My plans. I have the hardest time letting go of my plans. And I get so frustrated when something interrupts my plans. But that's how God seems to operate in my life all the time. That's why he's driving me crazy. He's interrupting my plans all of the time. And when I look at Simon, I think, oh, if I could just be Simon, who in that short walk from the city gate to Golgotha, carrying a cross of another man, couldn't take his eyes off him, couldn't leave, witnessed what he witnessed that day, said, forget the Passover. Something more important is going on here on this hill. A man that Sunday morning may never even heard about the resurrection, guys. He might not have ever heard about the resurrection that morning because it was kept hush-hush amongst the city. The disciples were even keeping hush-hush about it. They were gone within a week back to Galilee. He may never have heard about it until a man stood up on his last day of his trip. And once again, Simon is making plans, thinking, well, I don't know, if it would seem like an awful significant event back then, but I guess, you know, we're back on normal time. And see, what happened is you would plan your pilgrimage from Passover to Pentecost. And after the Feast of Pentecost, you would then go home. So this is his last day. He's actually paid up the hotel and had the checkout and headed down to the temple for Pentecost, and he's ready to go home. The bags are packed, everything. He's made plans again. And then some fisherman stands up in that temple and tells him that the man that he saw crucified, the man he carried the cross for, was raised from the dead and had begun a new community of people. And he responded. And God made a mess of his plans. You know what I love about Simon? The man's plans all along were go to Jerusalem and return to Cyrene. Well, boy, I don't know if he ever made it back home. I don't know if the man ever made it back home. Because we know most likely he is the Cyrene. We could go to Acts chapter 2. From the Cyrene from that little part of Libya, it says, and there was some Cyrene people that responded. He's most likely one of those guys. Well, they stuck around in Jerusalem. And they are the people that people like Barnabas sold their field for and kept fed and took care of, because they had no income and no way of making a living. They got stuck in Jerusalem. They couldn't leave because they needed to find out more about this Jesus. And then when he finally does leave, he doesn't go back to Cyrene. It looks like maybe he went to Antioch. And by the end of the century, 30 years later, his kids are still, they've made it to Rome. They still haven't got to North Africa. They're leaders in the Church of Rome. It looks to me like that Resurrection Sunday changed Simon's plans for good. And he never even made it back home. Because by the time Paul writes the letter to Rome, which is about 50 or 60 AD, it looks to me like Simon has passed away, because he is not mentioned, just his wife and his son. And it made that kind of an impact on him. But the last one. The last one will be brief. I know how his day started. It was a dismal day. It was a dismal day because he knew it was the day he was going to die. It started in a jail cell. It started with a death sentence. I doubt if they gave them a last breakfast. There was no hope for this day. It was dark. It was black. It was death. There was no hope. That's how his day started, and that's how he thought his day would end. And he is hauled out to Golgotha, and with two other men, one he may know, one he does not know. And there is a bigger crowd than he ever expected. He never dreamed that so many people would show up for his execution. Probably because he realized somebody, that other guy must be important. And then he hears that this other guy is one that some thought was the Messiah, that claimed to be the Messiah. And isn't it interesting that even in our darkest hour, even in our most desperate situation, human beings find a way to join the crowd? Because as the crowd hurled insults at him, he joined right in. He joined right in. Until he heard the words, "Father, forgive them. They don't know what they do." Those are words that would never come from his mouth toward a Roman. But he knew something's different about this man, so much so. And I've said this many times in preaching on Good Friday, there is no way in the world that man could see what he saw in Jesus, to see that he is a king, to see that he has a kingdom, to see that that kingdom would be established. There's no way unless God's Spirit opened his eyes. See, what this man didn't see at the beginning of the day is what only God could show him by the middle of the afternoon. "This is my son, in whom I am well pleased. Listen to him." And how did his day end? Well, Jesus tells us, "Today you will be with me in paradise." And how did his weekend end? You might think, well, the resurrection had really no impact on him. Oh, yes, it did. Putting a couple verses together, Jesus says to Mary Magdalene, "I have not yet returned to my Father." Paul says in the book of Ephesians that Jesus led captives captive. Captives are the dead people in the grave. He led them captive into the Father's presence. Guess what day he did that on? Easter Sunday morning. That man had a great Easter. He was captive in the grave. Maybe paradise, yes, but still the grave. But when Jesus rose from the dead, he led captives captive. He took that man into the very presence of God. He had the best Easter of all. He never saw that coming. He never saw that coming. And my challenge to each one of us is, which one of these guys are we? Are we a centurion who we see God working in our lives, but we're not sure what to do with it? And there's some question open of whether or not we will respond. Maybe we will, maybe we won't. Are we a Simon of Cyrene that we just can't escape what God is doing in our lives? And whatever plans we have, they're thrown out the window because of what Jesus did on that cross and what the Father did that Easter Sunday morning. Our lives have had to take a different course. And if they haven't taken a different course yet, we want them to take a different course now. We want our plans to be shelved and God's plans to replace them. And we want to see where he will take us and the life that he will share with us. Is that where we're at? I pray that is where we're at. Are we the thief who never saw it coming, but finally, after a life of failure, a life of mistakes, a life of wrong decisions, made one right one, and cried out to Jesus, "Remember me when you come into your kingdom"? And his eternity was transformed. Oh yeah, there's one other group we could be like. We could be like the religious leaders who mocked Jesus with these words, "He who saved others, he can't save himself." Oh, those are bad words, guys. "He who saved others, he can't save himself." All I can do is imagine a final courtroom scene with the religious leaders sitting in the stand. And Michael the archangel as a prosecuting attorney and saying, "Would you please replay that tape? What was it that you said? He who saved others. Can you explain to me why you're crucifying a man who you yourself acknowledged saved others? How did he save others?" Do you see the irony of the mockery? The religious leaders acknowledged Jesus had saved others because they couldn't deny it. He'd saved others like Lazarus when he raised him from the dead. And we're told by John that they actually believed Lazarus was raised from the dead. And they were frustrated because people were leaving them and going over. They did not question whether or not Lazarus was raised from the dead. They did not question the man born blind, John chapter 9. He was born blind, given his sight. Who gave you this sight? Jesus did. They didn't come to, no, he didn't. Especially after his parents showed up and said, yeah, he was born blind. What are we supposed to do? What did they do? They went to Jesus. How dare you do this on the Sabbath? Well, you know what the problem when you get mad at somebody for healing on the Sabbath is? You have to first acknowledge that they healed somebody. You cannot condemn a man for healing on the Sabbath unless you believe what? That he healed them. So you're mocking Jesus because he saved others. He saved this man by giving him his sight. He saved this man for 38 years who could not walk. Now he's carrying his mat. He saved this man who was in a grave, and now he is sitting at a table eating with his family and friends. And you acknowledge Jesus did all of those things. By your very words, you will be condemned. He saved others, and you crucified him. What business do you have crucifying somebody who saved others? How could these people be like us? I think our world is actually filled with people who see the hand of God in their lives all the time. They know God is working in their life. They know he's working in their heart. They see his hand, but they do not want to acknowledge it. They do not want to submit to it, and they do not want to surrender it, their lives to it. And as a result, like those religious leaders, they mock Jesus. And they mock Christians, not because they don't see the evidence of God at work in their life, but because they do not want to be a part of what that God is doing. They don't want to be a part of a servant Messiah. They don't want to be a part of a God who says, love your enemies. They don't want to be a part of a son, a Messiah, a king who forgives those who are crucifying him. They don't want to be a part of that. And as a result, they reject it. My prayer this morning is, we are all in the Simon of Cyrene camp. I don't even want us to be in the thief camp where we cry out in our last moment. I mean, yes, great day for him. But his life stunk. His life stunk. He had one good day. Simon. Simon had. Whatever time he had left, he had one great life as he followed God's plan for it and saw God's hand working powerfully through him, through his wife, through his kids. He saw his kids come to know Christ. He saw them as leaders within the church, friends of the Apostle Paul. Think of the things they saw in the life that they lived. That's what I pray for each one of you in this room, that you respond to Jesus and the resurrection, his death and resurrection, as Simon did. Let's pray. Lord, we thank you for